Well, we're holding Parshas Vayigash, but being that we...
I'm still on the page when we did the best breakfast on the best bagel.
We didn't...
he remembered today. Even in Naples, he remembered.
I'm still on the page where we got bagels a couple months ago.
We didn't do Parshas Miketz in our overview. We're going to begin with Miketz, because we're really starting the story in the middle. And then when we go in depth, we'll have to start with Vayigash, because that's the parasha we're holding in. So we had seen, we're holding parashas Vayigash. That's Perek Mem Dalet, the 44th chapter, Pasuk Yud Ches. But we're going to start our overview back in Miketz. Yosef has been imprisoned. He's been wrongfully charged with attempted... rape of his master's wife, and in jail, he's incarcerated with political figures, and that happens to be a good place to be incarcerated. Like a guy once told me, he says, "I got more contacts in jail than I did out of jail. I built up my my profession in jail. I got tips. I got don't ask me which guy it was, but." At any rate, Yosef is in jail with some pretty important people. And in jail he has already deciphered the dream of the two, the Sal Mashkim, Sal Ofim, the two officers, the butler and the one in charge of the bread, the baker. And his interpretations come true, and Paro has a dream, and he sees coming from the Nile seven beautiful fat cows, and they're grazing, and... then seven skinny cows come and consume the seven fat cows, and that sustains them. They don't die, but they don't get satiated. And Yosef's going to interpret this dream that this refers to the 7 years of plenty that are going to sustain Egypt, just like those skinny cows during the 7 years of famine, but it won't make Egypt fat, just like the skinny cows didn't get fat, but they'll have just enough to last out the 7 years of famine. And then Paro wakes up and he tries to figure out what it was, falls back asleep and has a second dream. And he sees seven stalks, healthy stalks, and then seven thin stalks that have been worn down by the wind, and they grow up and they cover the thick stalks. And when he awakens, so he calls in all his wise men and tells them the dream, and they can't figure it out. And Paro knows that this dream is of importance, if he has the same concept twice in one night, so he tries to find out. And the butler suddenly remembers. He says, "I have to remind you, I was once in jail. I once messed up. And when I was in jail..." So he's going to skip part of the story. When Yosef interprets the dream to him, Yosef had told him, "Do me a favor, say a good word to Paro. Maybe he'll allow me to come out of jail and be your own personal servant. Kim zechaltani itecha. Maybe, do me a favor, remember me and I'll be with you. I don't have to be in jail. I didn't do anything wrong to land in jail." And now this wicked butler finds himself in a situation where Paro's decreed anyone who can help me out and doesn't is liable for the death penalty, and he's scared he'll be found out. He doesn't know how many dreams Yosef's been interpreting in the last 2 years. So he tells Paro, and he does a job on Yosef. He says there was a lad, he was a servant, he was a Hebrew, you know, those defiled ones who eat our gods. And he over there really was able to figure out what our dream meant. And Paro has Yosef summoned. And Yosef's standing before the greatest emperor of the world. And this emperor starts telling him, "I dreamt a dream and no one could figure it out. And I heard that you can interpret dreams." And this young lad, who has the opportunity of a lifetime, has the gall to interrupt the greatest king and say, "No, not me. I don't interpret dreams. God interprets. God will answer you." You can tell yourself, "Wait a second, young man. This is the opportunity of a lifetime. After everything you've been through, you interrupt the king. So I guess it was a pretty important message to tell Paro. I'm not the one that's answering you. God's going to answer you." And Paro tells Yosef, "I'm standing at the edge of the river, at the edge of the Nile." And he tells him the dream. He leaves out some details. Yosef fills in the details, and Yosef interprets the dream. And Yosef tells him, "Look, this dream is really telling you that you have to prepare yourself during the 7 years of plenty. Now, Egypt is a country where they're accustomed to plenty. So the next 7 years where Egypt is going to have plenty, they don't know if Yosef's interpretation is true or not. It's only when the 7 years are up and the years of famine begin that they recognize, hey, the man was right. And during those years, Yosef enforces something similar to communism. He tells them, we have to take all the crops from the people. If you rely on people and you start taxing them, that's not going to work. So throughout these 7 years, Yosef sends his men, him and Paro, and they send their men in, and they take all the wealth, all the good crops that are growing for 7 years, they take to Paro's storage houses, and then they allocate. Each person gets a certain portion of food. Now, one understanding is they did it by force. Another understanding is that there was so much food, there was such abundance that the prices dropped down. And Yosef said, okay, now's the time to invest because we know the prices are going to go up. 7 years from now, we know all the prices are going to shoot up. There's going to be a famine. So he tells Pharaoh, I'm taking your wealth and I'm investing it in the food. So Pharaoh says, fine. He invests it in the food. And after 7 years, when there starts being a famine in Egypt and the surrounding cities, people are coming, knocking at the door to buy food. And now they're sending it back, they're selling it back at a much higher price. The price has gone up. And Yosef also had the wisdom to know how to store the food so that it doesn't get destroyed by vermin and stuff. So in 7 years, Yosef manages to amass a tremendous amount of food, so much so that the land of Egypt is called Vatas Aretz Likmatzim. It's like Jerusalem. When I came here 10 years ago, everywhere you'd go, you'd see them building. So Mitzrayim was the same thing. Everywhere you'd go, you'd see them building storage houses. They just couldn't keep up with the food. Wherever you went, they were building storage houses to store the food. And Yosef amasses all this food, and then the famine begins. And when the famine begins, they come to Paro and they say, we want food. And Paro says, go ask Yosef. And Yosef says, no. And they say, what do you mean, no? What have you been taking our food for? Yosef says, you guys still have food. Eat the stale bread, eat the old food. Right now there's nothing to talk about. So they all go back home and they finish the little leftovers that they have. And now they come to Pharaoh and they say, hey, we're hungry. We have no food. And at that point, they see Yosef's wisdom. And Yosef starts opening the storage houses and selling rations. He decides how much each family can get, how much each person can get. And they have to purchase the food from Yosef. The neighboring countries also had a famine. And the neighboring countries didn't have a Yosef. So they're running out of food, and they hear there's food being sold in Egypt. And when Yaakov sees this, he tells his sons, why wait till we're dying of hunger? Let's go buy food now. So they go down to Egypt, and we have the 10 brothers of Yosef coming to Egypt. How many years have passed? He was 17, and then he was 30 when he stood before Pharaoh. 22. Plus 7. Right? 7 years of good, and then 2 years of famine. So that's, he's 39 now. At the end of the story, he's going to be 39. And he was 17 when he left them. So 22 years have passed. Till the end of the story. Right now, 20, 21 years have passed. When the famine begins, 20 years have passed. And Yaakov holds on to Binyamin. The brothers come, and they enter through 10 different gates, and then they reunite. And Yosef knew that eventually they'd have to come down to Egypt. Now there's a burning question that's going to bother us. And we'll offer the answers that the Rishonim give. It bothered everyone. If you like it, good. And if you don't like it, also good. So keep searching. Find a better answer and share it with me. The question is, Yosef's been in Egypt for so many years. Why didn't he send word back to his father? Why didn't he say, hey, I'm okay?
He was afraid his father didn't miss him.
So one answer that's offered is that he really didn't know whether his father was in on the plot, right? There is that answer offered. And another answer that's given is that when the brothers had Yosef in the pit, so Reuven wasn't present. There were 9 brothers, right? Reuven comes back to the pit and he discovers they've sold Yosef. So the brothers said, we're making a cherem. We're making a ban on anyone who dares reveal what we're about to do to sell Yosef. They said, we can't have a cherem, we're only 9. God only rests his Shechina when there are 10. So one opinion says they joined God with him. Another opinion says they said, Yosef, you're still a Jew. You're still alive, you're one of the 10. And Yosef's sitting there silent, crying. And they start saying these Kabbalistic incantations. And they say, now there is a cherem. No one may reveal what we're about to do. And anyone who reveals is cursed by the force of the rabbis. And our sages have tradition that anyone who transgresses a cherem really has been hurt by it. So Yosef hears this, and now he's stuck. What's he going to do? All the years he's in Egypt, he can't send word back to his father. Till Yaakov's last day, he never is told that Yosef was sold. One opinion in our sages is that he figured it out himself. Another opinion is that he didn't know till the day he died. That's why the day after Yaakov dies, or after they bury Yaakov, the brothers come to Yosef and they say, Dad said we should tell you to please forgive us for all the things we did to you. If he really said that, why didn't he say it when he was still alive? The truth is, he didn't say that. But so long as he was alive, the brothers knew they were okay. Now that Yaakov passes away, so the brothers are scared, so they make up a story. So they come to Yosef and they say, Yaakov said before he died, please tell Yosef, please forgive your brothers for everything they did. And the reason they had to make up the story was because Yaakov never knew. They were scared if Yaakov ever found out, he'd curse them the way he cursed Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. So Yaakov never knew, according to this understanding. Yeah? Maybe there is. I'm not familiar with it, but it's quite possible there is. The question is, how does a child let his father wallow in sorrow for so many years? So we've offered two answers,
actually,
and we'll get to a third Bezachem later tonight.
There is a third also. Because Yosef knew that it's up to Hashem to reveal the hidden, so he didn't want to disturb Hashem's plan. Well, maybe like that.
So we'll go approximately down that route. We'll discuss it when we get there.
The 11 brothers bowed down to him in the dreams, and only 10 did. They were saying, this dream's not finished yet.
Right, so that's what the Ramban says. That's where we're headed. We'll discuss that as we get there. So Yosef has them summoned before him, and Yosef is wearing his Arab chic garb. His face is half covered. He's grown a beard. 22 years have passed. He's not the 17-year-old. Okay. And he says, "Where are you guys from?" He's not sure who they are. He thinks they're his brothers, but he's not sure. And they tell him, "We're from the land of Canaan. We came here to buy food." And then Yosef recognizes them each, and he remembers the dreams. And here the pasuk is giving us a key to understanding what's about to unfold before us. Vayizko Yosef et ha-chalomot. Yosef remembered the dreams. When we read the dreams, we think that it was a lad dreaming. But Chazal seemed to indicate that these dreams were of a prophetic nature. And Yosef had a responsibility to see them through fruition. And that's why Yosef remembers the dreams. And he says to them, you guys are spies. How come no one's come yet from the land of Canaan? How come if you're such wealthy people, you don't send your servants to buy food? How come if you're all brothers, you don't trust one another and you send one? Why do you all 10 of you have to come down? No. If 10 of you come down to Egypt and you all enter through different gates and then you reunite within the city, this is the way spies behave. You guys are liars. And they say, no. We came here to buy bread. We're all the sons of one man. And we're always united, all for one and one for all. We don't depart. We don't go places alone. And we're honest people. We've never lied in our lives. We don't lie. That's not us. We don't lie. Kenim anachnu. We are not spies and we were never spies. And if you verify, you'll hear about us. We never were spies and we're not spies. And Yosef says, no. You guys came here to see how this land can be attacked. I want to hear more about who you are. Who's your father? Who are your siblings? I'm going to verify. So they're scared. So they spill the beans. They say, we're 12 sons of one man and an important person in the land of Canaan. The youngest one is at home with our father, and one is missing. And here they're indicating that's why we went through the 10 different gates. We came to look for that one. And Yosef says, no, you guys are spies. What you're saying doesn't make sense. I'll test you. Bring back the little brother, and then I'll know that you're telling the truth. Send one back home, and you guys wait around, and we'll check out if you're telling the truth. And he puts them into captivity for 3 days. This story of the captivity for 3 days is not going to be mentioned again in the Torah. When they recount the story of their visit to Egypt to their father Yaakov, they don't make mention of it. They want it to sound good. They're coming. They're going to come back to Yaakov, and they're going to have to try and convince him, Dad, everything's okay. Really, just a little technicality. Send Binyamin down, and everything will be okay. So they can't tell him, yeah, we were in jail for 3 days. This man, he means business. They have to present it nicely. You guys all know Like when there's a car accident, how's the kid come home and tells father, Dad, everything's okay. Really, the car's okay. I just brought this shop for a little fix-up, a little tune-up. There was just something, a little skid on the ice. There's another car there. Yeah, it was a truck. Yeah, everything's okay, Dad. Really, really. So they're coming. They're doing the same thing. They come to Yaakov and they say, we went down to Egypt. There's a little technicality. You know, you come in, passports, border control. They have these questions. They want to just verify that everything's legit. They want us to bring down Binyamin. And that's why this story of their incarceration for 3 days isn't going to be mentioned again. And it's not going to be mentioned when Yehuda stands before Yosef and he says, hey, what are you doing to me? In our parasha, he's coming with claims to Yosef. We think one of his claims would be, what'd you put us in jail for 3 days for? He doesn't mention it. And we'll discuss why a little bit later. So, Yosef is working, he's working on them. If Yosef would come at the forefront and say, okay, leave me one brother, you guys can all go home, what would they say? No way, we just told you, all for one, one for all. We don't leave one behind. So what does Yosef do? He puts them all in jail for 3 days. Now they have time to stew. After 3 days of sitting in jail, he comes and tells them, you know what, I'm scared of God. You guys have families, your families have to eat, just leave one here, the rest of you can go home. Well, compared to the thought that they're all going to be stuck in jail, now that he's coming and telling them, just leave one, so now that sounds good. Now they're willing to accept it. If he would have come at the onset and said, leave me one of you and you guys go home, they would have said, no way. After they've all been sitting in jail for 3 days, now they're okay. Okay, so they agree. So they leave Shimon in jail. And he tells them, take the food and bring it home. And then bring back your little brother, and I'll verify that it's true. Why does he want Binyamin there? Because, like was mentioned earlier, he recognizes in the dreams a prophetic vision. So the brothers start talking and they say, you know what, we're to blame. We'd expect they'd say, because we sold Yosef. It's not what they say. They say, because when Yosef begged, we didn't have the compassion to recognize how he was suffering. They don't say we were wrong in selling Yosef. That thought has not yet happened. Till this point, and at this point included, they don't say we were wrong in selling Yosef. They say, you know what, he was a brat. You know what, he was wrong. And maybe when he was wailing and begging, please don't do this to me, we should have had extra compassion and listened to him when he wailed to us. Not that our justice was wrong. Our justice, they're maintaining, was right. He deserved to be sold. We did what was right. But maybe God is holding us accountable for not having extra compassion when he was begging. At which point, Reuven tells them, didn't I tell you, don't sin against the child, and not only what you're saying, that we should have had compassion when he begged, but also his life. Because you know what? He was a kid that was being spoiled. And he wasn't ready to be at work as a servant. Could be this caused his death. Could be he was sold down here to Egypt. And you know what? Maybe we're also being held accountable. We're also being held accountable for his blood, for his life. And Yosef all along is playing a game with them. He has a translator there. So they don't know that Yosef understands full well what's going on. Now this is a trick you guys should know you could do here in Israel as well. When you take a driving test, or if you're in a competition or something, so you're entitled to a translator. You're going to take Bagrut. Now, someone, you're entitled to have someone sit and translate there for you. What do you gain by that? You have more time to think about the answer than everyone else. So when the brothers are talking to Yosef, they say what they have to say, and then the translator has to repeat it. He has double the amount of time to think than the brothers. He understands it the first time. So he's sitting there thinking. And he's much more on the ball than they are. He's pulling them by the nose, as we see throughout the parasha. Yeah?
You have to provide your own translator?
No, I don't think so. And even in the Rabbanut, if you, those of you are going to go get tested by the Rabbanut, if you take a test for Smicha, you're entitled to have a translator, and you're entitled to do the test in English. That's when we'll discuss tomorrow night, Thursday night. So when Yosef hears them talking this way, he turns and cries. And he incarcerates Shimon in front of them. Chazal tell us when they left, he let Shimon out. So, Yosef commands his people, he says, fill up their sacks, give them food for the road, and he's showing them all the time, gentlemen, I'm a God-fearing person, here I'm giving you food for the road, you shouldn't even consume from the sacks, I want you to have extra food. He tells his servant at the bottom of their sacks, put in the money. Now, these were sacks that they'd close on two sides. So you could open them on two sides. So one brother opens it on the side where the money is. The other brothers open it on the side where the food is. When they reach the place where they're resting that night, one brother has a donkey that's weak, so he has to feed him extra food from the stuff that was stored. So he opens that sack and he finds the money and he tells the brothers, "Hey, my money's back." And they all get scared. They say, "What's God doing to us?" They come to Yaakov and they tell him. They say, "You know, the man who's in charge over there, he spoke toughly. He said we were spies." We said, "No, we're truthful. We're not spies. We're 12 sons of one man. And the young one is at home." And he said, the man said, "I'll only believe you if you bring the young one. And here, take food. Bring your family food." So they want to go back. They left their brother Shimon in jail. And Yaakov says, "You know, Shimon, he killed out Shechem. He was disrespectful. Let him sit. You ain't going back." And the brothers say, "But we have to go back. We're going to need food." And Yaakov says, "No, I'm not letting him go. You left me once, and my sons left, and you came back with one son down." Now Reuven lost the rights to the firstborn. Who was supposed to get it? Yosef. Last time you guys left me, Yosef was bumped off. This time you guys left me, who was next in line after Reuven? Shimon. Now Shimon's gone. Now you want to take Binyamin, the last one I've left from Rachel? No, I'm not doing this. So they're emptying out their sacks, and suddenly they see they have their money there. And when they see that, they get really scared. And Yaakov tells them, "Look, Yosef's gone, Shimon's gone, you want to take Binyamin? No way." And Reuven says his famous statement, "You could take my two sons, and they'll be collateral if I don't bring them back." And he says, "No way, you guys are fools, I'm not letting him go with you." He doesn't trust Reuven. Reuven sinned against him once. Yehuda tells the brothers, "Let's wait. He'll get hungry and then the facts will force our hand." And that's very often a good policy. Sometimes in marriage as well, we feel like we see where things are headed and we try to force our hands because we say, "Look, this is the price that's going to be paid. Let's do this so we don't have to pay the price." And sometimes the other side won't agree until they start feeling the price that has to be paid. And sometimes it's best to let that happen. You see, you can't win. So, okay, go with the flow, and eventually, when the other side feels it, then they'll understand it better. They start getting hungry, and Yaakov tells them, "Go back." And they tell him, "We're not going without Binyamin." And Yehuda tells him, "I'm taking responsibility, but we're not going without Binyamin." And Yaakov tells him, "What'd you do this to me for? Why'd you tell him Binyamin exists?" And they say, "Look, he started talking to us about where we come from. He asked about our father. He asked if we have a brother. We told him. Did we know where he was headed?" Yehuda takes responsibility and they come down. They take gifts for Yosef and they bring extra money to pay back the money they were given back and to pay for the new money. And they're going down. Yosef sees them and he makes a feast. They all eat, they drink. During the feast, Yosef starts telling them, "You guys, you used to sleep on the bunk bed in this side of the room. You guys, you used to sleep on that side of the room." He starts telling them about how their beds were set up as children. And they're looking to one another. How does he know all this?
He's from his cup. He's looking into his cup and he says that, "I see through my cup divine things."
Okay. So they leave and Yosef says, so the one in charge of his house called them in and showed them, "We're giving them back their money. They were shamed in front of all the Egyptians. We said they were spies. They're getting this load free. Give them back their money. They'll see their money is in their sacks. We're giving them back their money. And they should take the food and send them off." They're sent off and they stick the... He tells them, "But take the young one, put the bottom of his sack, put my special goblet." The people leave. They leave the city. And then Yosef sends his son Menashe, and he tells him to chase after them and start with the claims. What is this? What did you steal my master's goblet for? What kind of chutzpah is this? And this is where last week's parsha ends, where Menashe catches up to the brothers, and he says, "Why'd you guys do this? Why'd you pay us back so badly? We treated you so fairly. We gave you free food. This is how you pay us back? Give it back." And the brothers say, "We don't know what you mean. We don't know what you want. But if it's gold or silver, we didn't take any gold or silver from your palace." And he says, no, give it back. What do you mean? You guys took it." And they say, "We don't know what you want, but check our stuff." And they take off, they unload. And he starts checking with the eldest until he reaches the youngest, because he knows where it is. He himself put it in. And when they reach Binyamin's sack, and they reach it, so the brothers had said initially, they said, you know what? No one stole anything. If someone stole something, so he's responsible, not the rest of us. But we're so confident that no one stole anything that we'll all be slaves, and the one who, if you catch anyone, he'll be put to death. And he says, Menashe says, no, whoever is caught, he's the guilty one. You guys claim you don't know anything about it. Fine. He'll get the punishment. He'll be a slave. So they open up the sacks, and they discover it by Binyamin, at which point all the brothers tear their clothing. Menashe just caused all his uncles to tear their clothing, and for that Menashe is going to be punished, that his tribe is torn in half. Half the tribe is on one side of the Jordan, the other half is on the other side of the Jordan. The brothers remount their horses and come back and assemble before Yosef. And the parsha ends with the brothers saying, what can we say? You caught us red-handed. And Yosef says, no, I didn't catch you guys. I can't do that. One guy was caught. Leave him here as a slave. You guys all go home. And that's where last week's parsha ended. And our parsha begins with Vayigash Elav Yehuda. Yehuda is going to step forward. And there are many understandings as to what's happening here. Is Yehuda coming begging? Is Yehuda coming fighting? Is Yehuda threatening? Is Yehuda coming begging for mercy? Or is Yehuda coming out of strength? Yehuda steps forward, and we'll begin with the simple understanding that he's begging. He says, I beg of you. Let me tell you something, and don't get upset at me because I respect you like Pharaoh. I'm speaking to you out of respect. Yehuda assumes the man is a God-fearing person. The man keeps saying he is, and he keeps behaving as though he is. You asked us, do we have a father or brother? And we told you we have an old father, and we told you that he has a son that's very dear to him, and that he's the only one left from his mother. You told us, bring him here, and I'll take good care of him. We told you he can't. He'll die. And you said if he doesn't come here, don't come back for more food. And when we came back home and we told our father what you said, we thought we'd come right back. And this kid is so precious to our father that our father said, no, you're not going back. Even though it meant leaving Shimon here incarcerated, our father wouldn't do it. This kid is too precious for him. And when we ran out of food, only then did our father say, please go bring food. And we said, we can't go without the little one. And our father said, you know, I had one wife that I wanted. The others were forced upon me. I had one child. I had two children that I wanted. And one disappeared. And he's the last one left. Now let's pause for a second. The brothers initially sold Yosef because they were jealous of the special treatment that Yaakov afforded Yosef over the rest of them. So the brothers want to bump Yosef off in the hopes that that'll move them all one notch up with their father, right? They hold Yosef accountable for all kinds of things. They hold he's deserving of the death penalty. And they're hoping they'll move one notch up. From this conversation, we see that initially when Yosef was around, things were overt. Things were covert. Yosef might have gotten a slightly better gift, but they were all treated as equals. And now the situation has deteriorated to a point that Yaakov tells the brothers, and I don't know how to understand this, but this is what the Ramban says went on here. Yaakov tells the brothers, you know, there's only one kid left that I really wanted. The rest of you are like sons of the concubine. You're all like sons of Philakshim. I didn't want all the other wives. They are my wife. Kishnaim yaldali ishti. Ishti, my wife, Rachel, the only one who I really wanted to marry, she gave me two children and he's the only one left. So in the brothers' attempt to bump off Yosef and bring themselves all up one notch, they've knocked themselves all down many notches, which is something we find often in Tanakh. The people who attempt to do things wrongfully, to move up wrongfully, find themselves being knocked down. So Yehuda's begging, and he says, you know, our father said, this is the only one that's left. I've never seen the other one. I assume he was killed by a wild animal. And if something happens to him, that's it. The rest of my life is miserable. And now says Yehuda, if I come without this child, his soul is connected to his. And when he sees that the child isn't there, we'll have caused that our father wallows in sorrow till his death. And I took personal responsibility for him. So let me stay, I'll be a servant, and let him go up with his brothers. How could I go up and see my father's sorrow? And Yehuda's speech is so moving that the Egyptians standing around there start clambering on Yosef and saying, come on, Yosef, come on, king. Take the big one, take the big brother, let him go. And Yosef reaches a point where he says, I can't handle this. Everyone out, just me and them.
Oh, so they broke out before Yosef?
The Egyptians, yeah, the people present were moved. Yehuda was a good orator. He got everyone moved, and people started coming to Yosef one after another, saying, please, have pity on them. Have the poor father, everything he's been through. So Yosef says, I can't handle this. Everyone out. Let me talk to them alone. That's one understanding as to what went on here. Another understanding is that we're dealing with politics here. And whenever you're dealing with politics, there's what's said, and then there's the underlying what's meant. Yehuda realizes that this isn't fair. You're playing a game with us. And you're coming to us with a libel. There's no validity. Binyamin didn't steal. We didn't take any goblet. You made claims of us that you haven't made of anyone else. So Yehuda says, let's review what's going on here. I respect you like Pharaoh. And he's insinuating something. He's insinuating, he's saying, I know you're king, but you're like Pharaoh. Pharaoh made a rule that no servant could ever take the throne. And when you deciphered the dreams, so you became king. The brothers knew they were coming up against Yosef, so they did some research. And they found this out. So he's beginning by intimating to Yosef, you don't have validity even by Egyptian law to be sitting on that throne. So he's saying things but without saying them. He says, I respect you like Paro. Every time Yosef lied to them, Yosef would swear by Paro. He'd say, hey Paro, I swear by Paro, you're never getting out of this. Every time he meant to lie, he'd swear by Paro. So now Yehuda's answering him and he's telling him, I value you like Paro. And I want you to know, I come from a land where I'm as important in my land as you are in your land. Where, let's have a conversation, but let's set the stage. Paro took my grandmother, Sarah, because he coveted her beauty. There's no logic in your taking him, other than that you're coveting his beauty. We know this is Egypt, where everyone lives for lust, and all improper relationships are rampant. People don't know who their father is, who their mother is, who their wife is. Everything here is immoral. So you're looking at him because of his beauty. Because, you know what? If someone purchases a slave and discovers that the slave steals, he's a kleptomaniac, he goes back to the seller and says, that's not the slave I meant to buy. Here you have a young man who you claim you caught as a thief. That's the person you want serving in your palace? No. Something here is wrong. So Yehuda tells him, let's review what's going on. Please don't be upset. I have respect for you like Paro. We mentioned what he's insinuating. You asked us, do we have a father or brother? Are we the first people to come here, purchase food from Egypt? Everyone else that comes, you don't ask these questions to. Everyone else that came from Canaan, you didn't ask these questions to. But suddenly we come in, it's as though it's a shidduch. You suddenly want to know who's the father, who's the brother. What's going on? You've been planning things from the day we walked in. Your treatment of us was unfair from the day we walked in. You said, bring him in. I'll take good care of him. This is how you take good care of him. One understanding in Chazal, we're going to discuss tomorrow, there's a fascinating medrash here about what the conversation between Yehuda and Yosef was. And it's a worthwhile medrash. We learned it last year and the year before. But for tonight, I want us to move forward to try and cover the whole parsha. And then tomorrow night, Bezat Hashem, we'll discuss this medrash.
Who brings what you just said?
Which part of what I said?
About you is the meaning behind you're saying you respect you, but I respect the Pharaoh.
Part of it is in the Das Akenim, part of it is in the Ramban. So Yosef is standing there before his brothers, and he's going to do an act of bravery. He's going to say everyone out, and he's risking his life. They're 10-on-1, but he doesn't want to embarrass them. Yehuda has just told Yosef, he says, I can't go home without him. You might think that the reason I want to stay in his stead is because I could escape more easily. No, life is not worth living for me if I come home and see my father in that state of sorrow. Yosef is being bombarded. He can't contain himself. And he says, everyone out. And Yosef knows that when you say everyone out, everyone's out, but they're listening at the door. So Yosef begins by telling them, I am Yosef, your brother. Now, if you'll notice, throughout all the stories that they told Yosef, they never mentioned the name of the brother they're missing. They said, we had a brother, he's missing, he's gone. They never mentioned that he was sold. They always said, he's missing, he died. They said all kinds of things, but they never said he was sold to Egypt as a slave. So when Yosef identifies himself to the brothers, he tells them, I am Yosef. And the Egyptians by the door hear it. So everyone starts talking. Oh, Yosef's brothers are here. The brothers are scared. And Yosef says, guys, come close. And now he wants to talk to them quietly. He doesn't want Binyamin to hear. There's no reason to create enmity between them and Binyamin. Even though Chazal said Binyamin knew all along what was going on. He named his children after what was happening to Yosef. And his stone on the breastplate was Yosh-Peh, the letters of Yesh-Peh. He knew all along, but he had a mouth to speak, but he didn't speak. He never recounted what happened. But Yosef calls his brothers forward, and he says, I'm Yosef, your brother. I'm the one you sold down to Egypt. Now, once he tells them that, they never told anyone that they sold Yosef to Egypt. There's no way he could know that. So he says it quietly because if the Egyptians at the door would hear it, what would the Egyptians say?
Oh my crap, they sold their own brother.
That's what they'd say. They'd say, people who could sell their own brother, if they could turn on their brother, for sure they could turn on us. If they're not loyal to their own family members, for sure they're not going to be loyal citizens. We don't want them here. The last thing we want is to have them here, and we don't want Yosef either. So Yosef knows that if word gets out of what happened between him and his brothers, then the Jewish people in Egypt are in a problem. And he himself has a problem. And the world has a problem because the world needs him in this position right now. So Yosef calls them forward and he quietly tells them, I am Yosef. I'm the one you sold to Egypt. And they stand there and they're in disbelief because he's the one they sold. He's the one that was a slave and now he's standing here as a king. They're standing in disbelief. And Yosef tells them, look, the famine's been only 2 years. There are still 5 years to go. And you have to know that God wanted me in this position because this is what's keeping the land going. If not for the fact that I'm here, then the world, we'd have much less world population right now. A lot of people would be dead. Now, I can't start sending food out to Canaan because the Egyptians will think I'm amassing wealth out in Canaan and they won't let me get away with it. The only way I could sustain you and the family is if you guys come here. There's a limit to how much food I could send you out there, and the famine is only going to get worse. If this is what it looks like 2 years into the famine, you guys can't sustain yourself. You still have 5 years to go. It's only going to get worse. You guys have to come here, and over here I'll be able to sustain you and the family. We have the land of Goshen, which is a country very near Egypt. It became annexed to Israel. In the book of Yoshua, it's enumerated with the cities of Yehuda. And this was a piece of land that Paro had given our great-grandmother Sarah. So he said, this land of Goshen, I know Dad won't want to live in Egypt. He won't want to live near everyone here. So we'll live in Egyptian territory, in an Egyptian colony called Goshen. And Goshen, the Egyptians won't protest because that's land that really was given to us as a gift, our great-grandmother, to Sarah. So he tells the brothers, you guys are going to die if you don't come. But when he sends word to his father, he says it more gently. He says, I don't want you to become impoverished if you stay up there. The high rates of food these days. You come down here and things will be easier. So Yosef tells them, I want you to know it's me. Look, I'm talking to you, Lashon HaKodesh. I'm talking to you Hebrew. Now that's not a very strong proof because Egypt was just near Canaan. There probably were many Egyptians who knew how to speak the language of Canaan. And especially a king, it makes sense that he would know. The main proof that Yosef tells them that it's me is he says, I am Yosef, and you sold me to Egypt. The fact that he knows to say the name, which they never told him, and the fact that he knows to tell them that they sold him, which they never recounted that they sold their brother, that's the real proof.
What about the time that he's at the dinner table telling them where their beds were in the room?
So now they could figure out how he knew that, but at the time he claimed he did it by witchcraft, by sorcery.
So if they believed in them, why couldn't they not believe that he found out that by witchcraft?
That's true. That's true. So Chazal say he also showed them he was circumcised. That's a little bit going far to prove a point. But that you could also question, because Chazal also say that when they ran out of money, when the Egyptians ran out of money, he made everyone circumcised. So all the Egyptians were circumcised. We'll learn about that next week. Why? So it doesn't say why, but we could think of why. If the main Egyptian problem was that they were having immoral relationships, so this is a way of helping the people contain themselves. This is a way of helping them become a more moral society. So Yosef had always told Pharaoh's house, he'd always told his friends, I come from a good family in Canaan. I really was taken here, I'm not a slave, and I was taken here by force and sold. They kidnapped me. He didn't say who. I was kidnapped and sold here to a slave. I have a good family out in Canaan. And now that the brothers are coming in and they recognize they're famous people in Canaan, they're wealthy people in Canaan, they're a noble family in Canaan, so everyone in Pharaoh's house is happy. Yosef's words came out true, and they hadn't taken a slave and placed him as king over them, but rather this was a noble who was kidnapped and sold into slavery, but he's a fine person and he's fitting to be their king. Pharaoh tells Yosef, he says, I know, you're always very careful with my money. You're not going to take stuff to send back home to your father, so I'm commanding you, I'm ordering you, take from my stuff and send your father things back home. Now, the law was in Egypt that you couldn't take out, they had special horses, you couldn't take out even a wagon with food. They'd have to carry it on their own or on a mule, but you couldn't take out a wagon out of Egypt. And Pharaoh says, I'm giving you my wagons, and you take, even though the law is you don't take wagons out of Egypt, take my wagons and bring food and bring the family down to Egypt. Yosef tells the brothers, he says, I'm sending the wagons, but that doesn't allow you guys to be lax in the midst of Kibbutz Aveim. Dad, you carry on the shoulders the way we always carried him. I guess they had some kind of bed that went on the shoulders that the sons carried him on. And for the families, you take him down to Egypt on the wagons. And then he says, and I know, I remember, even on the night we had a war pending with Esav, that Yaakov, our father, was worried about all the little vessels. So tell him not to worry about the vessels. I'm going to give him everything he needs. He's got to come down now. There's a famine pending. He should gather the stuff and come down. Yosef sends a tremendous amount of food up to his father. And he tells the brothers, look, I'm sending you with a lot of food. And you'll come back down to Egypt with all of your wealth. Don't worry about armed robbers. I'm famous. No one's going to mess with you. About robbers.
Oh.
I'm famous. Everyone knows that the surrounding area can't last without me. No one's going to mess with you. You guys don't have to worry. Don't worry about enemies attacking you on the road. They come back to Yaakov and they tell him Yosef's alive. So he faints. And they start telling him Yosef's alive and he's lying there looking into space. He doesn't register.
But Sarah, but Asher is...
So we'll get to that. So hours are passing and they keep telling him Yosef's alive. He's the king. He's okay. He sent you all these things. And he doesn't believe it. And after a while, they're telling him, he comes out and he sees the wagons. And he says, okay, now I believe it. I mean, Egypt never lets wagons out. This is a sign. So they're sitting there telling him all the stories about Yosef's wealth. And he says, Rav, he says, enough. Tell me, is he alive? They say, yeah. So he says, okay, then let's go see him. All the stories, that's not what's important. They're standing there telling him, and he's not convinced. So he goes to Rav, to the one who's in charge of the wagons. And he tells him, psst, you, our wagon driver, I believe you more than I believe them. Tell me, is it true what they're saying? Is Yosef alive or not? He figures if they decide to con him, so they could all get together. But they wouldn't think of telling the wagon driver. So he goes out to the wagon driver, and he tells him, tell me the truth. Is Yosef alive or not? So he says, yeah, Yosef's alive. So after he tells him that, so Yaakov's spirit comes back to life. He gets rejuvenated. Yaakov goes to bring sacrifices, and these sacrifices are exceptional. It's the first time that we find in the Torah that someone brings a sacrifice that's not an Ola. A Ben Noach, the Bnei Noach, their sacrifices are always an Ola. Everything gets burned for God. Yaakov, now towards the end of his life, has attained a new spiritual height. He has all 12 children, and on that level he is fit to bring Shlamim, he brings Zvachim. He brings a sacrifice that brings peace to the world, a sacrifice that everyone eats from. The man eats from it, God eats from it, the Kohanim eat from it. So he brings that sacrifice now, and God appears to him and calls out to him, Yaakov, Yaakov. And that's a big letdown for Yaakov. Until now, God's been telling him, you're Yisrael. You can contend with kings. You can contend with angels. You're amazing. And now when he's about to go down to Egypt and he's coming to ask God for permission, God reminds him, Yaakov, Yaakov, you're leaving your home territory. You're going into exile. You are no longer going to be afforded the ability to be Yisrael. You're entering a time, a period of Yaakov, where you're going to be at the bottom. And you should know, Anochi alcha gamalo, I'll come back out of Egypt with you. Anochi alcha gamalo, I'll uplift you, I won't let you be downtrodden in Egypt. But nonetheless, don't assume that you can contend with kings and angels now. Now's a period that you're going down to Egypt, and you have to be aware that you're entering a period of Yaakov, the level of, at the bottom, at the level of the heel. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I'll come back up. So Chazal tell us, whenever we went to exile, God came with us. When that's true, there are a lot of things they didn't say. When we count the children of Yaakov, so we come up with 69. And the Pasuk says there were 70. So Chazal say, yeah, that's God. God fills our number. When we left Egypt, it says we were 600,000. And Chazal have a tradition that we were 599,999. And God said, I fill in the missing number. That's the tradition we have. So when we go down to Egypt, God goes with us. Yeah, Eli.
I couldn't have said any time, but Yisrael Yashar is coming up. So what are we supposed to learn from the amount of shinui that people have to do, that Israel has to do in order to... I mean, are we supposed to be striving to try to tell the truth? Are we supposed to... What do we learn today from the amount of manipulation that's taking place in so far in the Sefer Bereishit?
Let's try to get back to that in a minute, okay?
Yeah. Big questions.
Can I ask a question?
Sure. But first tell me what your name is.
You're sure. Okay. The 600,000 which came out of Egypt, that was just the males, but the angels, which I'm assuming God doesn't come under the category of.
Correct.
So that probably means that he wouldn't have been one of the...
For sure. Yeah. It's a midrash. No, it doesn't mean... the Medrash is going to give us a message. I don't think the numbers, we have many ways of understanding how it's 70, and we find many times the Torah rounds a number. The Torah will often refer to 39 as 40, and 79 as 80, and 49 as 50. We find many times that numbers are rounded, either to the closest number or to the closest whole number. Okay. One of the things that we were given when we were given the Torah is the Targum, the translation of the Torah. We have a tradition that when the Torah was given together with it, God gave an explanation in Aramaic called Targum. And this translation was handed over generation to generation until Unkelos, the Ger, came and transcribed it according to our tradition. But he didn't invent it. He transcribed the tradition we had going back to the time the Torah was given. A tradition that was reinstated by Ezra. The Targum is very careful whenever we have descriptory terms of God to say them in a way that precludes our understanding that God takes on physical form. The Targum always says a term that seems to indicate that God is not physical. If it says that there are many examples, that God went down, so he'll say God revealed himself, not that God went down. If it says that God heard, so he'll say it became revealed before God. Every time we have a physical term, a term for movement, term for some physical action, the Targum is careful to translate it in a way that we cannot understand it as being physical. But there are exceptions. One of the exceptions is in our parsha. When Hashem appears to Yaakov, Hashem says, I will go down to Egypt with you. And the Targum translates it literally. God says, I will go down to Egypt with you. And the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim discusses at length the Targum throughout the Torah and Yonatan ben Uziel throughout the Navi. And he discusses these exceptions. So the Rambam explains that over here, God was talking. God said, I will go down to Egypt with you. When God is talking, God can use physical words. God does use physical words. And then the translation, the accurate translation, would be the exact translation of that physical word. So when God is talking, God says, I will go down. The Targum translates it that God said, I will go down. When the Torah is describing what God did, when the Torah says God went down to see what happened in Sodom and Amorah, so then the Targum is careful to say, it doesn't mean literally that God went down. When it's a description of something that happened, the Targum is careful to teach us that it doesn't mean that it physically happened that way, but rather it's a description of God's revelation.
He wants to judge the Sodom and Amorah. He wants them with the court, with the angels, in other words.
Okay.
That's why it went down.
So
Hashem is everywhere, so you cannot read it.
It's important to note that the Ramban in our parsha on this pasuk, where the Targum translates it literally, that Hashem said to Yaakov, I will go down with you, there's a long Ramban that discusses this Rambam. And he takes issue with the Rambam. And he takes issue with a few points. We'll just mention them because they appear in our parsha. Firstly, he says, how come is it that when the Psukim discuss God's hearing, so very often the Targum will translate it literally. And when the Psukim discuss God's right side or God's right hand, the Targum will translate it literally. And when the Psukim discuss God's finger, so the Targum will translate it literally. It says you have luchos that were engraved with God's finger, and the Targum translates it literally. Now, what does the Rambam do with all of these? There God isn't talking. It's a description that the Torah describes. And another thing that the Rambam says that the Ramban disagrees with in our parsha is the concept of Shechina. The Rambam says whenever it discusses Kavod Hashem, Hashem's honor, or the Shechina, it's a reference to a physical revelation of God in this world. The Shechina is something physical. It's something physical that God reveals in this world that mankind can see. So the Ramban says no way. He says, we find that whenever we have a discussion of the Shechina, the Targum is careful to use the same hidden terms that he uses with regard to God. He says there was a revelation. He doesn't say they saw the Shechina. When it says the Shechina appeared to the elders, it says there was a revelation of the Shechina. Just like he'll never say man saw God, because we cannot see God. He'll just say God revealed himself to man, because he revealed as much as he wanted to reveal. Says the Ramban, if we're going to go like the Rambam, that what God does when we discuss the Shechina is that God takes something physical, makes a physical revelation to mankind. So then what's wrong with saying he saw it? Why does the Targum have to go in this roundabout way and say, no, there was a revelation of the Shechina to mankind? If the Shechina is something physical, then the translation should be he saw it. Because just like we see one another, we can easily perceive something that's physical. So the Ramban basically says this is all Kabbalistic concepts. And as we discussed, the Ramban already tells us in his introduction that when he's going to discuss Kabbalistic concepts, we won't understand him. So we're holding true to his introduction. We don't understand him. At least I don't. But at least we should be familiar with this argument between the Ramban and the Rambam as to how to understand when the Targum translates things literally. Do we say, like the Rambam says, that's an exception and we'll fit it into the rule? Or the Ramban says, no, there's nothing wrong with translating it literally. There are other reasons why the Targum will use other terms. But the Targum was not doing what the Rambam claims he was doing, to try and steer us away from thinking God takes on physical form. Now, if we could just take one more step, the Rambam develops concepts both in his philosophical works and in his halachic works, and he basically says that no one can say differently, and it's impossible to view things differently, and there's no logic that can be validated with a different approach. Now, the Rambam's philosophy to a great extent was accepted. It's quoted in halacha in many places. The Shulchan Aruch quotes from the Rambam not only in halacha but also in philosophies. We have many places that are quotes from the Rambam verbatim. What the Ramban does in his commentary on the Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvos and other places, the Ramban protects. He comes to argue and say, wait a second, we can go like the Rambam, but we can also validate the opinion that the Rambam is saying has no validity. Because, says the Rambam, says the Ramban, says Nachmanides, this is the opinion of great Rishonim. So we can't just say, no, that's illogical, that's wrong, that's impossible. So even though the Rambam does say that, much of what the Ramban does throughout his commentary, both on the Rambam and on others, is protect. Be it the Ramban on the Rif, where he's coming to protect the Rif from Rabbi Nizrachi Alevi, the Mar Baal Hamar, the Mar HaGodo, or the Ramban on the Rambam, where the Rambam throughout the introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvos is going to attack other opinions, and the Ramban says, wait, no, we can validate that opinion. Maybe they had a different version in the Gemara, maybe they had a different understanding in the Gemara. One of the issues that the Rambam writes in the beginning of Halacha, in the beginning of the Yad HaChazakah, is the Rambam says it's impossible to say God takes on physical form. So we know that the Ramban disagrees with the Rambam in that understanding of angels. That the Rambam says angels will never take on physical form, and the Ramban says, yeah, they do. The angels walked into Avram's tent. The Rambam says, no, that was all prophetic vision, it didn't happen. We might be able to find a correlation between this argument and that argument. Because if angels are an extension of God, as it's possible to understand, and according to the Ramban, angels can take on physical form, so then the question is, where does that lead us with our understanding of, does God ever take on physical form? And if the Rambam says angels never take on physical form, so certainly Hashem doesn't. Okay, that's just something to think about.
Maybe to him there were men.
Ah, that's a good question, right?
What?
Right, that needs to be defined.
What
right.
did you say?
That depends on how we understand the whole Rambam in one wheel turning another wheel, in the beginning of the Yad HaChazakah, where the Rambam says the angels are all part of this gear system, that you have God who's the master turner, and then you have a bigger wheel, and then another wheel, and then another wheel, and they're all being turned, and they all turn one another. So the question is, what's the connection? How do we view that? I don't know the answer to that.
Maybe the...
Just a second, Ellie's waiting. Yeah.
For Ramban, I mean, is it's from the... from our, because we're the ones who are living in this world, that's why the angels could be physical, because we're perceiving it. Is that the reason that it's possible that it's physical? And rather than... just to make... Put Ramban with the Ramban, and to still protect against thinking that Hashem is something physical.
I don't know. It says that when Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, so he went down with his sons and his daughters and his granddaughters. Who were those daughters? So Chazal tell us that the daughters is a reference to his daughters-in-law. It's important to know that a son-in-law and a daughter-in-law are called children, a person's own children. The Gemara says if a person is careful in lighting his Hanukkah candles and his Shabbos candles, well, so he'll merit to have children who are big Talmid Chachamim. And then it says we have the father-in-law of Rav Shizvi. He was always careful in lighting his candles. And one of the rabbis walked by and said, there'll be a great man coming from this house. And his blessing came true. He had a son-in-law named Rav Shizvi. So you see, your son-in-law is also someone who is attributed back to their parents-in-law. If a person is merits, so he has children who are great. And if he merits, he has sons-in-law who are great. And it goes both ways. We discussed that the halacha says one's supposed to call his parents, his parents-in-law, mom and dad. And by the same token, they don't hold back from calling their sons-in-law and daughters-in-law son and daughter. So here we see it in our parsha, that the parsha refers to his daughters and really it's a reference to his daughter-in-law. If we're going to say that that missing person in the number of 70, the Torah tells us that 70 people went down to Egypt. So we have a tradition that even though the Torah enumerates 69, Mrs. 70 was Yocheved. Levi's daughter Yocheved was born as they entered Egypt. So the problem with that is that we know they were in Egypt 210 years. And Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old when they left Egypt. That would mean that Yocheved was born 210 years before we left Egypt. And she bore Moshe when she was 130 years old. Now, that's a greater miracle than Sarah, who gave birth at age 90. So that's why the Ibn Ezra says, nah, doesn't mean that. And the Ibn Ezra has a few places throughout the Torah where Chazal say one thing and the Ibn Ezra says, nah, that's Drush, that doesn't work. So the Ramban, this is the place in our parsha where the Ramban, who greatly values the Ibn Ezra, even though he'll disagree with him, says with in his introduction, he says, with Ibn Ezra, we're going to have a revealed war and a hidden love. Ahava mesuteret, he calls it. He says, with the great rabbi, the Ibn Ezra, we'll have a hidden love. But overtly, we're going to argue with him. So over here, this is the place where he really takes on the Ibn Ezra, and he says, no, pshat in the psukim is indicative of this medrash of Chazal. You don't have to go too far. He says, Levi, how old was he? Levi was already an old man when we went down to Egypt. If you're going to say Levi had children when at the end of his lifetime, in order to make Yocheved a little bit younger, she'll still be an old lady. And nonetheless, you'll end up with a miracle that Levi, who's such an old man, can have children. I don't understand this Ramban so well, because from what I know, at least today, and if I'm not mistaken, it's a Gemara that way, that the oldest person can still possibly impregnate a woman. That's not a miracle. That a woman can have children after a certain age, that's a miracle. So the Ramban says a very important rule. He says, the Torah doesn't harp on miracles. The only time the Torah bothers making mention of a miracle is when we have a prophet or an angel who introduces the miracle, who says, look, a miracle is going to happen. Then the Torah makes note of it and tells us. Because, says the Ramban, the Torah is all about miracles. The Jewish people are all about miracles. When the Torah tells us, keep the Torah and good will happen. Well, there's nothing natural about the fact that if we don't keep Shemitah, then it won't rain. That's not natural. That has nothing to do with nature. He says the way the Torah tells us to live our lives, that we'll keep the Torah and things will be good, that's not natural. That's a promise the Torah gives. The punishments of the Torah, that's also not natural. So the Torah doesn't get excited from what we'll call miracles. The only time the Torah makes mention of it, like by Sarah, is when we have a prophet who foretells us, or an angel that foretells us, look, a miracle is going to happen. There the Torah says, okay, now take note, the miracle did happen. But the fact, just one second, but the fact that Yocheved had a child at 130, that he says doesn't contradict any Jewish philosophy. Fine, it was a miracle. The Torah doesn't bother mentioning many miracles. And he enumerates other people like Obed, David's grandfather, who also was a very, very old man when he finally had children. He says, we find that there were many old people who had children, and the Torah doesn't bother making an issue of it. Sorry, yeah.
Adam Arishan was living 930 years, and Abraham was 165, so
the Ramban also does that math. He has
the Roman Empire, they lived 200 years straight.
Okay. The Torah, when it enumerates Yaakov's children, so it says, these are Yaakov's children, aside from Yaakov's children's wives. And the question is, if you told me you're going to enumerate the children, why do you have to tell me, except for his wife? Tell me except for the neighbor's wife. What does that have to do with it? The Torah said, I'm going to enumerate the children, and it says the children's numbered such and such, aside from all their wives. So from here, it's indicated that their wives were part of Yaakov's children. This is where we derive from that Yaakov had children, that the children married their own sisters, their half-sisters. Their sisters through the father, which a Nohai, the Ramban says, is permitted to do. A Nohai is only prohibited if it's a sister from the mother and the father. But if it's just a sister through the father, then the Ramban says it's permitted. I don't know how we rule on that halachically. Yosef goes out to greet his father. And the Torah describes it that Yosef went up towards his father. And this teaches us something. Very often when we're going to perform a mitzvah, so we feel down. A guy could say, I'm learning in Beis Medrash, my parents flying in, I have to stop my learning, I have to go to the airport to greet my parents, oy vey. So the Torah teaches us that when a person is going to greet his parents, he's going up. He's going to perform mitzvah, we're going up. Sometimes it's a question of our focus. A guy called me the other day, he said, I have a chavrusa, it's going terrible, I have to end it with him. We know we're ending in a week, I feel like I have to end it today. So we discussed that really halachically, he owes the guy. You can't just dump a guy on a minute's notice. The guy's counting on you to be his chavrusa. You can't just walk in to say to him, that's it, today it's over. If we agreed, we're going to learn a certain amount of time, so even though for me it doesn't seem beneficial, I can't just one day walk in and decide that's it, it's over. There's a certain amount of menschlichkeit. I got to give him fair warning to find someone else, to help him find someone else. And at the end, I told him, look, sometimes it's perspective. If you walk into a chavrusa and you think, boy, I wish I could learn now as best as I could. So then every minute that you're not learning as best as you could, you feel like the ground's burning under you. I'm sitting here and I'm wasting the minutes, and he's not catching on to the Gemara, and every minute is difficult. But if we walk into the chavrusa and we think, okay, now I'm coming to perform the mitzvah, v'ahavta re'acha kamocha. That's what I'm doing here. I'm not coming here for the learning. I'm coming here, I know I'm not going to get the learning I want done. This isn't working the way it should, but at least I'm going to perform this mitzvah now. That's my focus. So sometimes the change in attitude could make the situation much more amenable. And Yosef, when he's going to greet his father, he's going up. He doesn't say, well, I'm the head of state here in Egypt. I got a million things to do. The Gemara says, if you take all the rivers and make them dry, and take all the trees and make them pens, and take all the land and make it parchment, and you start writing down, you still won't be able to figure out how much depth there is to a king's heart. How much a king has to evaluate so many different things on each day. There are so many things going through his mind. So Yosef is the head of the top empire. He's got a lot of things to do, but no, he goes out to greet his father, and for him he's going up. Vayad, he's going up towards his father. Another understanding is because Goshen, where he's going to greet his father, is really a part of the land of Israel, as we find later on. That Goshen was annexed to Israel, so Israel was higher than Egypt, that's why he's going up. Yosef is coming out towards his father, and he's dressed in his Egyptian garb. He's dressed in his Egyptian garb, and his father's already an old man, and he looks and he sees this Egyptian coming towards him. So he's looking, and the brothers are looking, and they're all not sure who this man is. So Yosef comes and he falls on his father and he starts crying. The one understanding is that when Yosef came to his father, so he came up to his father and his father put his head on his neck and started crying just as he had cried for 22 years. And this, says the Ramban, is the more easily understood understanding. Why? Because he says, think about it. You have a father who spent 22 years lamenting his missing son. For 22 years he's been crying, he's been in mourning, nothing tasted good, life's been bitter, he's been missing the son. You have the son who's been going through life, he's made it, he's head of the biggest empire. He finally gets to meet his dad. How much is he really going to cry? Nature says, nature dictates that the father, oh, he's going to cry. Finally, he sees the son. But the son, he's going to cry, but it's not the same thing. So he says, it seems that the Pasuk is stressing how much Yaakov cried over Yosef. Some point out that we don't find that Yaakov kissed Yosef. Yaakov sees this Egyptian coming up to him, and then he's going to see this Egyptian has kids, and he's always wondering, where is he holding? I know he made it. I know he made it financially. I know he made it politically. But where is he holding religiously? And that we're going to discuss next week, how Yosef, at the end of his father's life, tries to show him, Dad, I'm okay. Throughout all these years, I've kept the Torah the way I should. And when he finally convinces his father, then his father says, okay, if you were able to make it out in Chutz La'aretz, then Jews for generations to this day will bless their children. You should be like Ephraim and Menashe, Yosef's children that he managed to teach them, even though he was in exile, alone in a foreign culture. After Yosef finishes speaking to his father, he says, let me go back and tell Paro. He says, e'ele, I'll go back up and tell Paro. And the Torah is telling us a nuance. It's telling us that when Yosef came to greet his father, he got off his high horse, he got off his chariot. Sometimes a person feels like, I'm the CEO. My mother's coming in and she starts combing my hair. My mother comes in and says, you know, your necktie isn't straight. My mother comes in and she pulls my head down and gives me a kiss. It's not comfortable. I'm the boss here. Everyone's seeing me this way. So Yosef wasn't that way. Yosef, when he comes to his father, he gets off his chariot, he comes down, that's still my father, he treats him with respect, and he treats him like a son should treat his father, even though he's the head of state. And when he says, I got to go back to Paro, then he says, okay, I'll go back on my chariot, I got to go. Now he's going to go and go back to his duties. The Jews are partitioned to live in Goshen, and Yosef knows that his father won't want to leave in Egypt. The Egyptians don't like the Jews. They don't like the Hebrews. Firstly, because they eat sheep, and it would be like if I told you, I'm going to sit you next to a Chinaman. They eat live snakes. You know, they just swallow, you know, like spaghetti. So everyone's going to say, I don't want to sit next to him during the meal. So the Egyptians viewed the Jews eating sheep the same way. For some reason, in Egyptian culture, eating sheep was...
They didn't eat sheep.
No. The other understanding is that they ate other meats. But they viewed eating sheep like we would view eating snakes. The other understanding is that they used to worship the sheep. The god of Egypt was the Tle. So that's why they couldn't fathom sitting next to a Jew when he's eating their god. Yaakov comes before Paro, and Paro sees his the hair on his head is white. The hair on his beard is white. He's all white. So Yaakov says, old man, how old are you? So Yaakov tells him, no, I'm not so old. I'm only 130. But I look old because of all my suffering. I've suffered so much throughout my life. And that's something that Hashem doesn't like. A heavenly voice in heaven, God said, I saved you from Esav. I saved you from Lavan. I gave you back your daughter Dinah. And now I just gave you back your son Yosef. And you say, my life was short and bitter? Hashem took the sentences from Vayomer until Bimei Migurai, and every word in that verse, God detracted a year from Yosef's life, and that's why from Yaakov's life. And that's why we find that Yaakov's father, Yitzchak, lived to 180, and Yaakov only lived till 147.
There's exactly 33 words.
Exactly 33 words, yeah, you could count it. So, to conclude, our parsha ends with Yosef reunited with his brothers, and I want to share with you a beautiful Dvar Torah that Rabbi. There are two Dvar Torah that I think are very important. I don't know if we'll get to both. Sometimes in life, when we're facing a challenge, so we feel like, how's it ever going to end? How am I ever going to get out of here? And sometimes we feel like the people said about the Titanic. They said it for the good. They said even God couldn't sink this ship. Sometimes a person feels like even God couldn't get me out of here. I don't see how I'm going to get out of here. So Rabbi Yort always used to tell me the following Dvar Torah. Imagine you have people who were, they've just had a tough time with the authorities. And they're being brought forth before the judge, and they've been caught red-handed. They haven't done anything wrong, but they've been caught red-handed. And they're standing there, and they're trembling. And they themselves said, you know what, if you catch us, then we're all sold as slaves, and the one you catch is dead. Their families are waiting for food. And now they're all standing there trembling before this emperor, who has the backing of the people, and he's the most powerful emperor in the world. And he's telling them, you're caught. Now you're going to pay. And they don't see how they're going to get out. And their best bet, their long shot, what they hope maybe will get away with, is that their leader, their head, Yehuda, can go forth and say, I'll be a slave instead of him. They don't have hopes higher than that. Their highest hope at this point is, if we get what we want, if we get our plea bargain, then Yehuda will remain a slave for life in Egypt, and we'll go back home, and we'll at least bring Binyamin back home safely to our father. And as they're standing there, and the whole earth is trembling around them, Chazal say Yehuda let out such a roar that his nephew Chushim ben Dan came down from Canaan and said, Uncle Yehuda, what's bothering you? What are you so upset about? I heard you out to Canaan roaring. Chushim ben Dan was deaf out in Canaan. So they're upset, and they don't see a way out. And then in two words, this emperor turns to them and says, Ani Yosef. The whole picture changes. Suddenly everything makes sense. Now they understand everything they've been through, and they understand how they're going to get out of it, and they understand how everything's going to be good. And the whole picture looks differently. Two words, Ani Yosef. And the whole picture looks differently.
So,
when we're faced with challenges in life, we have to remember that we're on a set. We're playing a role. We're doing our best. And even when things seem like, how's it ever going to get better? With two words, the whole picture can change. It's just, we don't know what those two words are. We don't know how it's going to get better. Just like the brothers didn't know. They were standing there and they didn't know where it's going to get better. And there's one more thought that I think is worth mentioning. Yehuda was knocked down by the brothers. They said, if you would have spoken up, we wouldn't have sold Yosef. Look at how our father is suffering. You shouldn't have let us get away with it. And then Yehuda went through his whole ordeal with Tamar. And now all the brothers are standing there. Yehuda's begun ascending to leadership with his plea bargaining with the father. And now the moment comes when he's got to put his money where his mouth is. Binyamin's in danger. And it's like the bodyguard who's been training to protect the president. Someone's pulled a gun, and the question is he going to jump in front of the president and take the bullet or not? And Yehuda steps forward. And when Yehuda steps forward, so Yehuda is saying, I'll be a slave. Take me instead of him. Let him go back up to our father. I'll serve you. I'll be a better servant. Yehuda means what he says. Yehuda's standing there willing to give up on seeing his wife ever again, seeing his children, seeing his father, being separated from the whole family, living the life of a slave, and he doesn't know what kind of treatment he's going to get in Egypt. But that's his responsibility to his father and his brother. 10 minutes later, Yehuda's on top of the world. He's king. We have to remember that the Torah, when the Torah gives us power, power goes with responsibility. If he's the king, then he's the one that's going to stand up there and say, I'll take the bullet for my people. He has the responsibility, maybe not literally, but to stand up there and like David said, Yinayadcha bi, when he sees the Jewish people suffering, he says, God, punish me, don't punish them. I don't want to see my people suffering. I'll take the bullet. And that's the trait we see here in Yehuda. When Yehuda steps forward and he's willing to give up his whole life for the sake of one brother, that's when he shoots up the greatness. That's when Yehuda becomes the Yehuda who leads the brothers, who's ultimately the king of Israel. And the same thing is true within the home. If the Torah gives certain rights to a husband, it's only because there are more responsibilities. The rights come with responsibilities. And a husband has to know, like the halacha says, if there are limited funds and a yom tov's coming up, so those limited funds go to buying her, if they're of equal need, to a nice suit or her getting a nice dress, she gets it. He has to buy it for her. When the Torah gives a husband certain rights, and that those rights go hand in hand with the responsibility of taking care of all the people he has the rights. The rights were given only as a way to facilitate taking care of the people who really give him those rights. Shabbat Shalom. Bezvat Shem tomorrow.